There's a story about two parents who had two sons. One was 8 and one was 10, and they were what you might call extremely mischievous. That was a word my mother taught me to say about my little brother instead of saying that he was mean. I was supposed to say he was mischievous. But at any rate, they really were pretty bad, to the point that in the little town, if anything went wrong, the parents were pretty sure that their sons were somehow involved in it. And so just having really given up everything they knew, they eventually consulted their minister. And he said, well, I've been able to turn around several young men. I would be happy to meet with them, but I'd like to meet with them separately. And I think I will meet with the 8-year-old first. So the 8-year-old came to the minister. The minister set him down and said, son, there is something you need to ask yourself. And that question is, where is God? Well, the little boy didn't want to give the wrong answer, so he didn't say anything. And then the minister said, I ask you a question, son. Where is God? Again, the little boy didn't say anything. This time the minister pulled himself up, kind of banged on his desk and said, son, this is the last time I'm going to ask you this question. Where is God? Upon that, the little boy was so terrified, he ran out of the minister's office, ran home, and hid in a closet. His older brother came in and said, what happened? He said, we're in big trouble this time. God is missing, and they think we did it. Well, today we're going to explore a story that really does explore that essential question, where is God? And our story comes from the book of John in chapter 4. And I'm just going to read just the beginning at first. Now when Jesus learned that the Pharisees had heard Jesus is making and baptizing more disciples than John, that would be John the Baptist, although it was not Jesus himself who did the baptizing, but his disciples, he left Judea and started back to Galilee. But he had to pass through Samaria. I think this is, okay, it is working. I thought mine wasn't working. Okay, so let me get myself together here. All right, here we go. Now, it's important to realize that Jesus' decision to head north is really significant, north of Galilee. Reverend Herbert Hunt, in a study of the New Testament, says, here we are dealing with a momentous decision on the part of Jesus. Now, the reason Jesus decided to head north was really twofold. I think I've got the wrong slide there, sorry. There we go, let's leave it there. Really twofold. One was his disciples were beginning to baptize more people than John the Baptist. Jesus himself really didn't do any baptism. He sent the disciples out to do it. But they were beginning to actually baptize more people than John. And Jesus just did not want there to be any controversy or conflict about this at all. And the other reason is that the more Jesus' ministry grew, the more worried he was that the Roman authorities would take all of the just the persecution that they were really involved in with John the Baptist at the time and turn it toward Jesus. And Jesus had work left to do. And Herbert says that this decision to go north not only altered the course of his ministry, but also prolonged his productivity for 2 more years. It gave Jesus 2 more years on this earth to do his work. And because of this decision, we have the record of some very important happenings, some outstanding teachings, and some very practical lessons, which are as applicable today as they were over 2,000 years ago. This is by Herbert Hunt. And so, actually, I think Jesus made the right decision to head north, because just after the event we're looking at today, John the Baptist was beheaded. And that could have happened to him, certainly. So now, looking at the map there, we see very logically that if Jesus is in Jerusalem here and he is wanting to go to Galilee, the shortest distance between those two points would be right through Samaria, wouldn't it? You see it on the map. However, the author of John makes a point to say, but he had to go through Samaria. Now, The thing is, this route, the direct route from Judea to Samaria, or I should say to Galilee, would have been absolutely unheard of in the time. No one would have gone that way. And the reason is, the way they would have gone actually is they would have left Jerusalem, gone to Perea, and then around Samaria all the way to Galilee. So they would have completely circumvented Samaria. Why? Well, there had been a long, long hatred and rivalry between the Samaritans and the Orthodox Jews. And that had started way back in the exile, at the time of the exile of Babylonia. The Samaritans were descendants of peasants, actually, who were left behind during the exile because they were considered unworthy even enough to go along. Just imagine that. And since they were left behind, they ended up intermarrying with other non-Jewish tribes and people, and that lowered their status even more in the eyes of the Orthodox Jews. So there was a lot of bitterness, there were wars, there were conflicts between them for centuries. Also, the Samaritans, they were the descendants of this group, and they believed also that they were descendants of Abraham, as they were, actually. However, their worship differed so much from the Orthodox Judaism that further fueled the hostility between the groups. So there was no friendliness, and it wasn't even really safe to go through Samaria. So keep this in mind as our story continues, because that's a really important part of it here. So Jesus came to the Samaritan city called Sychar, you can see it on the map, near the plot of ground where Jacob had given to his son Joseph, that he had given to his son Joseph. And Jacob's well was there. I know you've heard of Jacob's well. Jacob's well was there. And Jesus, tired out by his journey, was sitting by the well. And it was about noon, midday. A Samaritan woman came to draw water. And Jesus said to her, "Give me a drink." His disciples had gone to the city to buy food, so he was by himself. The Samaritan woman said to him, "How is it that you, a Jew, would ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria?" And the little parenthesis in the text says, Jews did not share things in common with the Samaritans for the reasons that we've already talked about. Now, at this point, we know nothing about this woman, do we? We don't know her name. We don't know her age. We know one thing, that she is a Samaritan. Yet, her conversation with Jesus is one of the longest dialogues recorded in the entire Gospels. It begins with Jesus making a simple request, which was, what did he ask the woman? "Will you give me a drink?" And that seems so reasonable. That seems so reasonable. I mean, it's hot. He's traveled all day in the desert. Of course he's thirsty. And, you know, it just seems reasonable that he would be thirsty and ask for a drink, except for a few facts. One, Jews were not supposed to even speak to Samaritans. Two, men were not permitted to address women without their husbands present. Three, a rabbi, which Jesus would be considered at that point, especially had no business speaking to any woman in public, not even his wife. Some men in the audience may think that's a good thing, but anyway. And fourth, it would have been very unusual for a Jewish person to ask a favor or to accept a drink from the cup of a Samaritan. It would have really been unheard of. Now, the woman is focused on the rules, isn't she? But Jesus, we will see in a moment, is focused on something greater. So we continue the story in verse 10. Jesus says to her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is who is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water." The woman said to him, "Sir, you have no bucket, and the well is really deep. Where will you get the living water? And are you saying that you are greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us this well?" Jesus said to her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, but those who drink of the water I give them will never be thirsty. The water I give them will become in them a spring of water gushing up to eternal life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I may never be thirsty and have to keep coming to this well to draw water." So The woman still doesn't get it. Jesus is speaking symbolically, as he did so many times. The living water has nothing to do with satisfying her physical thirst. It's not water for the, it's not anything for the body. He is offering her living water for her soul. And as I said, she doesn't get it, and she immediately launches into a litany of practical questions, straight from her intellect, challenging Jesus. But you have no bucket. How will you get the water? Are you greater than Jacob? All of these questions she's asking him. And yet, despite her doubt, finally she says, okay, give me this living water, and I can avoid these daily trips to this well. Still not understanding that Jesus is offering her living water drawn from the indwelling well of truth, the inexhaustible supply of light, love, and peace. And with this water, she will never be thirsty again. Now, there's another thing about this scene that the people of Jesus' time would have immediately grasped that we really don't get today. And that is, why would this woman come to the well in the middle of the desert at noon? The hottest part of the day. Water was always drawn during the cool period of the evening. That's when the women came together to get the water for the day, to talk, share family stories, bond with each other. It was sort of like the Starbucks on the corner, only I guess it wasn't quite as expensive. The water was free. And it was just a place to connect with friends and neighbors. It would have been highly unusual for a woman to come there alone, and this explanation takes a different meaning as the story takes kind of an interesting twist. And now we're in verse 16. Jesus says to her, go, call your husband and come back. Because, you know, the rule was she was supposed to have a husband with her. The woman answered him, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you are right in saying you have no husband. But you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not really your husband. And she says to him, what you have said is true. Sir, I can see that you are a prophet. So traditionally, in Christianity, this woman is portrayed as a scum-sucking sinner because she's had all these husbands, and she's with somebody who's not her husband at the moment. Now, actually, as far as her five-husband history goes, that would not necessarily have made her a loose woman, as the term was years ago. Perhaps she was simply a survivor, because in antiquity, men died really young. I mean, just factor in hard work, famine, disease, warfare. I mean, the life expectancy was not very long for males. And a widow who had no brother-in-law or male relative to take her in usually had three choices if she wanted to survive. She could become another person's wife, she could become a beggar, or she could become a prostitute. And so in that sense, maybe she made the wisest possible choice. However, living with the sixth man without marriage would have made her to be considered a sinner in that day and also a social outcast. So that's probably why she came to the well in the heat of the day. She didn't want to be subjected to all the scorn of all the other women, who certainly would not have treated her well. But notice Jesus' response to her. He knows her history, but he does not judge her. He gives her, a Samaritan woman with maybe a little bit of a shady past, he gives her one of his most important lessons. And thinking that he is a prophet, the woman decided to debate theology with him. And she says, and now we're in verse 20, she says to him, our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you say, meaning all that's what the Jewish people taught in those days, you say that we must worship in Jerusalem. Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither in Jerusalem nor on this mountain. The hour actually is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeks such as these to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. And the woman said to him, I know the Messiah is coming, and when he does, he will proclaim all things for us. And Jesus looked at her and said, I am he. I am the one who is speaking to you now. So we have to remember that the early Israelites thought that God dwelt in the temple of Jerusalem, that that's where God was, in that inner sanctuary that was called the Holy of Holies, and only the priests could go in, and only then once a year. And the Samaritans had a similar belief. They thought that God dwelt in their temple, which was on the top of Mount Gerizim, which is the mount that Jesus refers to in what we just read. And what revolutionary idea does Jesus give this Samaritan woman? He says, the hour is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You will worship the Father in what? The Spirit and the truth. That's exactly right. And Jesus is telling her here an important thing, that God is omnipresent, not limited to any one place, not Jerusalem, not Samaria, but wherever we are, God is. Jesus gives this message of freedom not to a woman he sees as a sinner, but to a human being he sees as the Christ. Ed Townley says, Jesus realizes the woman is spiritually starved, living under limitations imposed by religious authorities. She's been told by the Jews that God can only be worshipped at the temple in Jerusalem, and yet, as a Samaritan and a woman to boot, she's forbidden from even entering the temple area. All the women could do was wait outside. And Jesus tells her on that day, God is spirit, and spirit cannot be limited to any temple. God is everywhere present, and what is needed is to worship God in an awareness of spiritual presence and the energy of truth that allows that presence to flow. And our story ends today with the woman spreading the word to the point, to all the other Samaritans, to the point that many of them came to believe in the ministry of Jesus because of her. In fact, they asked him to stay two more days, and he did stay two more days after the story ends, teaching and sharing his truths. And Townley says, this woman at the well was one of the first true disciples, carrying the message of freedom to other Samaritans. So the woman considered the scourge of society becomes a shero. And in that adventure, she also learns about spiritual freedom. Now, we're not told, interestingly, whether her living situation changes. Jesus doesn't even make any demands on her. He doesn't say anything to her about that. But we can guess that empowered with truth, aligned with the presence of Spirit, she goes on to make life choices that might be a little bit different. And speaking of life choices, what is the message of this story to each one of us today, personally and spiritually? We know that Charles Fillmore taught that every single Bible character, every situation, is supposed to show us something about our own spiritual journey, about our own soul development. So, what do we learn from the woman at the well? Well, remember the Samaritans were a mixed race, both ethnically and religiously, because they intermarried during the Babylonian exile. And metaphysically, the woman of the well represents mixed consciousness. On the one hand, the soul nature, which really aspires to understand the spiritual truth, but on the other hand, draws most of its understanding from the intellect. And don't we sometimes do the same thing? Don't we sometimes block spiritual truths with intellectual questions and concerns, just as she did when she was questioning Jesus' ability to draw water? Don't we argue with divine inspiration, saying things like, who, God? Me? Not me, God. Or sometimes we get into that motorboat mentality, you know, the but I can't do this, but this is not possible, but I don't know how. And remember, the how is the work of the ego, always. When we align with us that omnipresent power of God, we are receptive to divine inspiration. We give up the motorboat mentality. We step out in faith, and we leave the how up to God. And how many times in our lives, all of us, have we focused on our thirst for those things in this outer world that seem so important to us, just so important. We pursue the false gods of status and stuff, thinking we need more money, a more prestigious title, more stuff, like this woman. That look familiar to anybody? Leaving us in what I'm calling the TMS syndrome, too much stuff. And what happens there is we put so much energy in pursuing these outer goals that we leave no time to quench the true thirst of our souls. What does Jesus tell the woman? He says, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again, meaning our stuff, our status, only satisfies for a little while, and then we want more and more. But those who drink, Jesus says, of the water I give them will never be thirsty. Jesus refers to that living water as representing really spiritual understanding, that which is awakened and begins to flow. The Daily Word talked about the flowing, that begins to flow when we acknowledge the presence and life-giving power of Spirit within. And in this story, Jesus models an attitude that I personally believe the world needs so badly at this moment in time. He refuses to buy into the prevailing hate and distrust about the Samaritans. He ignores the customary route, and he cuts right through the country, also cutting through the prejudicial, narrow-minded attitudes and fear that were prevalent in the culture about the Samaritans. He breaks all the rules, and he engages the woman in substantive conversation. He just sits down and leans in and talks to her. He doesn't judge her lifestyle or her religious beliefs. He acknowledges that there's a cultural divide between them, but he doesn't use any divisive language. He gently guides her to see her relationship to God differently. To me, he's modeling here that divine love is a magnet, reminding me of the epigram by Edward Markham, which is one of my favorites. I bet a lot of you know it. It's called Outwitted, and it goes like this. He drew a circle that shut me out, heretic, a rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle and took him in. And Jesus draws the woman in, and doesn't divine love always win? And so Jesus helps the woman and us, I hope, to see that God is not located in any temple or building. There is never any distance between God and us. We live and move and have our being in and through the divine. And our daily word and our first hymn today talked about coming to the garden of prayer. And we come to that garden alone, and that garden is in our own souls. God is always there. There is never any place that we can ever be that God is not. In church, on a golf course, at a concert, and on the street, we are always standing on holy ground. Our job is just to expand our consciousness to understand the magnificence of God, to know that Spirit is present in its entirety at every point in the universe. That is so hard for us, our human brains, to wrap around. God is not just present everywhere, but he can express fully everywhere in the universe. And that means God expresses fully in every one of us. And that, thank you, God, is our greatest gift. And so it is. So let's take a few moments now, just as we prepare for prayer and meditation, to affirm the great truth about our omnipresent God, that there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is. Together, there is only one presence and one power in the universe and at work in my life, God, the good, omnipotent, and so it is.